Welcome back to Shake Up Your Workup, your go-to veterinary podcast for daily diagnostics, where each episode we dive into innovative diagnostics and real-world clinical practice to help practitioners navigate both typical and not-so-typical workups. In this episode of Shake Up Your Workup, Dr. Sylvia Conway sits down with parasitology expert Dr. Wade Burton to take a closer look at tapeworm infections in dogs and cats. They'll dive into emerging antigen testing, walk through tapeworm life cycles, and discuss zoonotic risks, treatment decisions, and practical prevention strategies. You won't want to miss this. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Shake Up Your Workup. I'm your host, Dr. Sylvia Conway, and today's episode is Tape It or Leave It. Should we worry about tapeworms or any worms for that matter? Our guest today is Dr. Wade Burton. And Dr. Wade Burton is an IDEXX Global Medical Affairs Specialist for Infectious Disease and Parasitology. Welcome to the show, Wade.
Thank you. Great to talk to you again.
Now, Wade, I know you say again, so this is your second time on the show. We're very, very pleased to have you back. But we've had to think of a new intro question for you because it is your second time. So what we'd like to know today is, what dog breed energy best represents you and why?
Well, it's got to be the Labrador because it's my favorite dog, and I've owned a Labrador for over 40 years now. Not the same Labrador, but I've always had at least one or more in the family, and I think it's just because they're loyal, they're trustworthy, they're dependable, and they like people. So I think those are the things I probably most identify with when it comes to dogs.
They do say that you start to morph into your dog, don't they? The owners start to slowly morph. So you're slowly becoming a Labrador, you think?
Yep. They run the house.
Not a bad way to be. Okay, so today's topic is about worms, more specifically tapeworms. So we're going to start off in terms of testing, because obviously this is going to be based around diagnostics. That's what we talk about on Shake Up Your Workup. Why should we test for tapeworms and not just treat with a dewormer sort of quarterly or even more regularly than that?
So the primary reason is because if you're going to choose to routinely treat for this group of worms, is do you know the treatment worked? How do you know the treatment actually worked, was effective? Was it the right dose? Did the pet owner successfully administer it? Did the animal ingest it? And if you don't test, you don't know if something works. And we've got numerous examples over my career of the emergence of resistance or selection for resistance to a particular, in a particular parasite to a treatment. And if you don't test, you don't know. That's the simple answer.
And in terms of testing, traditionally it's been quite difficult to detect tapeworms by fecal flotation. Can you run us through why that is?
Yeah. So simply, whether we're doing passive or we're doing centrifuged fecal flotation, which is a recommended method, the solutions, the specific gravity of that solution, how dense is it, is generally less dense than these eggs. So these eggs are heavier, so they don't float easily. Do they float? Occasionally. You do find them, but it's what's considered an insensitive method of finding these. And then the second reason is the eggs or egg baskets, depending on the tapeworm, aren't always released within the feces. They may still be contained within the proglotted segment that's being shed, and those eggs may not be released until after the proglotted is shed with the feces. So it's really kind of both of those. But the primary reason those egg baskets are too dense.
So it's basically a fecal sinking rather than a fecal flotation for these.
Correct.
So we know about fecal antigen testing, or I'm sure most of us know about fecal antigen test. And specifically, the IDEXX fecal antigen test has been able to detect the flea tapeworm. That was added not so long ago, I think a year or so ago. That was added 2 years ago. It was added to the testing platform. What is the clinical significance of that particular tapeworm? Is it Dipylidium?
It's Diplidium caninum. Don't look at how it's spelled. Just just memorize it. At least that's what I do. So short, the flea tape, commonly called flea tapeworm in North America, or Diplodium caninum, is transmitted by the flea. Its intermediate host is the flea. It has to become infected, and then the dog or cat has to ingest a flea. It's a pretty different life cycle from many other tapeworms, but it's very common. So it's in many places where fleas are common. Diplodium caninum or flea tapeworm is the most common tapeworm seen, because all you have to have is your dog has to have fleas. And there's a lot of pet owners that don't think they have fleas, but that's because their cat or dog's really good at eating fleas. especially cats. Many people don't think their cats have fleas, but that's because they groom them off so fast and eat them. And the evidence of them having a flea infestation or having fleas is they keep having tapeworms. So it is, but in other parts of the world, for me living in the South in the United States, it's hard for me to understand places that don't have fleas, but there are places, you know, in Northern Europe, in Canada, in out in the desert West, they don't have a large number of fleas. So they very rarely see Diplodium caninum.
And in terms of the other tapeworms, so I think the tinea tapeworms are the ones that we're all kind of concerned about, the ones that we remember from vet school, the really kind of nasty ones. The IDEX test has now got the capacity to detect these. Is that correct?
Yes. So we've expanded the menu again and added a marker that contains a specific antigen from this taeniid group of tapeworms. And taeniid tapeworms include taenia species and echinococcus species. And yes, these are the ones that if in certain species, if a human or a dog or any canine becomes an accidental intermediate host, it causes severe or clinical disease. Your dog being infected with the adult worm in their intestines is just another tapeworm. It doesn't cause significant disease in both of them, but it is very different because, yes, this is what scared all of us in vet school was you're going to eat undercooked meat, which is what mm-hmm. they all scared you about.
I remember this.
And you're going to get really sick and don't eat. Those tapeworms, at least in North America and in developed countries, are extremely rare because we have eliminated those from our commercial food sources. We just don't see those beef tapeworm, pork tapeworm. We don't see them because they don't ever enter our food supply. If they're infected, that doesn't get into the food supply. So if it doesn't get into the food supply, the dogs can't, or the canines or whatever, the definitive host can't be infected, and we've broken the life cycle effectively.
But can you just remind us briefly, for those of us that haven't thought about these since vet school, what is the typical lifestyle cycle? Yeah. I was going to say lifestyle. Yeah. Life cycle of the...
Well, it is the lifestyle of the parasite.
Yeah, a nice relaxing lifestyle, just the movement, a bit of pork.
So we'll, in general, both of the taeniids in general have the same definitive host, intermediate host, back around. So when you say, you know, life cycle's a circle, so I'll start with the dog ingests, they have to prey or predate, they have to scavenge and eat something off an intermediate host, whether that's a rabbit, a rodent, a hoofed mammal, depending on the species, but they have to ingest generally the viscera or internal organs. That's where these larval cysts are. There's also in the muscle in some of them, but that primarily it's scavenging, predating. Those cysts then develop into the adult tapeworm in their intestines. They shed just like the Diplodium and other tapeworms. Then as the mature, they start breaking off those little segments, the proglottids. And like with taenia or with flea tapeworm, you can see those. You see those little white rice or cucumber seed looking things you may see on the fur or on the feces. With echinococcus, the tapeworm is only 3 to 5, maybe 7 millimeters long. So you don't see the segments because while they're not truly microscopic, they're so small, you're not going to notice them. But once that gets shed, that definitive host, those eggs are then released into the environment, and the rabbit, rodent, ungulate, hoofed mammal, whatever, ingest those eggs, and then those cysts develop in the intermediate host, and the life cycle goes around again.
And Are there clinical signs that I would see in, say, my pet dog if it was a definitive host for this?
So in general, no. Very rarely, with the Tania species, almost never. They may have some itching around their perineum associated with the proglottids. There's been rare reports of dogs having so many tapeworms, Tania tapeworms, that they cause an intestinal impaction. But in general, no. You notice, if it's Tania, you notice the segments. That's what you notice. Now, with Echinococcus, again, there are rare reports of dogs with large number of Echinococcus multilocularis infection that they may have bloody diarrhea or they may have some kind of diarrhea associated. But those are still what I would call the extreme cases. Most of them are definitive hosts that are that create no clinical signs as a definitive host.
And can I be sure? So if I run the test, the antigen test, and I get a positive result, can I be sure that this is showing that there's a living worm in the gut and it's not picking up antigen from some other source?
We have good evidence to show that again and again and again. And the reason is the antigen, the specific antigen that was developed that we are detecting is specific to the adult living worm. It's only present when the worm, in general, all of these, but with the tapeworms, we know it's associated and we can show that it's, that they are actively infected. It's not that the antigen is persists in the environment, you know, and they could eat somebody else's poop or something. It's not going to survive that digestive force, as it were, and be in any level that would be detectable. We've seen no evidence with any of the antigens that it's not associated with anything but the adult parasite that's how we selected for these markers, is it's associated with the adult form of the parasite at an active infection, not associated with eggs, not associated with other environmental things that may mimic it.
So what exactly, so it's detecting an antigen in the adult worm. Can you kind of describe to us a little bit more in depth what exactly it's detecting? I don't know if that's interesting or not.
With, in general, there's some specific protein marker antigen that is released within the feces when the adult parasite is present. That's from the 50,000 foot view. When we talk about going to the tapeworms, we know that it's associated. It was developed from the adult worm, from the proglottids. And so it is something that is released or excreted, an antigen, into the feces when that adult parasite is present. And then we develop antibodies to detect those antigens. Okay. So it's not the things that could come off of an egg or a dead parasites don't produce these kind of things. And each one of them is a little bit different. Some of them, like with some of the, with the nematodes, the hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm, they're either associated with host, they release these into the feces to hide from the parasite, from the immune system, don't see me, or it's associated with attachment to the body wall. It helps with that kind of thing. So it's different with each parasite.
So my understanding is that the test will give you kind of a positive for there is a Tinea species present. Is there a reason why the test is not more specific than, oh, it's a Tinea, but we don't know which one?
Well, so this came out of, there's many reasons, but primary is as a screening test, we could get high specificity and accuracy at the Tinea level at that, because they're very closely related. And for antigen and immunoassay, it got a specificity in what's truly a screening test, where we expect most of them to be negative. Because as you get into, when we say these are common, we're still talking about overall population, maybe, you know, less than 1% of all of them are going to be positive. Now in individual areas, it might be more, it's going to be higher, you know, but when you get down into less than 1% or 1% positivity, you start getting into the area of, you got to make sure you have really good specificity, because if you sacrifice specificity for sensitivity, down at the species level, you start tipping over into, well, I could have as many false positives as I have true positives. And that's a bad space to be in when you're using a test as a screening. That's the primary reason that we went this route, and we found a marker that was had high specificity to this small family of parasites. Just like with roundworms, aren't all the roundworms, they're different genus and species, but they're all closely related.
So we touched briefly on the kind of the scariness of these particular worms. And I think the zoonotic or zoonotic risk is always something that we remember from those scary images that we were shown during vet school about some of these tapeworms. So if I receive a positive on these this teeny screen, should I be thinking about the possibility of zoonotic risk? What should I do? Do I need to do something more to confirm that this is not one of the nasty ones that could be an issue?
So there is always that concern. And I'm gonna answer this in from a practicality standpoint and from a zoonotic risk concern. Practically, the good news is you get a positive flea tapeworm, you get a positive pain ear. The same drugs at the same dose are effective against all of them. We start talking about Prozicron, Quantel, Efsipronkel. The same dose treats has been shown to be effective against all of them. Benbendazole with the tanias, but in general, if you just say, okay, I got a tapeworm positive, I want to treat this dog, and I'm going to talk about, to me, I would talk about good fecal hygiene anyway. Pick up the poop, wash your hands. Don't let, you know, young children or elderly people that may not remember, you know, are not good about washing their hands. And you're going to virtually eliminate the risk and handle it. Now, from a zoonotic, is this truly a definitive host zoonotic infection? Which, when we're talking about tanians, we'd be talking about, are these one of the echinococcus species, multilocularis or granulosis? That's where what we can do is then run a PCR. We know we have a tania. Now we have a high degree of the PCR is very sensitive. And if that's a positive for echinococcus, then we know it's the significant zoonotic risk. And then we can appropriately, like if it's a reportable disease in your state, well, you know, it's not reportable from a CDC standpoint in the United States, but in Canada, I'm fairly certain it is. You know, in parts of Europe, there are mandated regulatory things about it. Then you can do your duty and report, I have an echinococcus confirmed PCR positive. So, you know, me being someone who really likes parasitology, would I probably always order it? Yes. Would it change how I ultimately manage the patient that doesn't have any clinical signs and just is a positive? I would make the same recommendation anyway, because a tania positive, regardless if it's tania or echinococcus, if you prevent the animal from predating or scavenging on the intermediate host, you break the life cycle. So doing something different, not letting your cat roam around, you know, not letting your outside dog go hither and yon and finding dead things on the, you know, on the ground, if it's a problem, you know, to me, that's the practical way as a veterinarian that I'd approach this. Again, somebody is I like parasitology, I'd want to know. If the pet owner says, well, it doesn't really matter to me, that's on them. You give them the risks. You tell them how it would change what you're going to do and let them decide. The last thing I'll say about it is there are many places, you know, throughout North America and Europe where echinococcus and echinococcus transmission, primarily multilocularis, is of a real significant concern. And so those are the areas that probably are going to have a higher number of people that want to know. And that's why we offered it in that method, quite honestly.
And in terms of treatment, so if I got a positive and there were other animals in that household, so cats, dogs, whatever, is it necessary to treat all the animals in the household or just the animal that had the positive?
I would say the short answer is no. You can't directly get it, a tanian tapeworm, from another animal. Flea tapeworm you can, because you're probably sharing fleas. But what I would ask as a veterinarian, so this dog is positive for a Tania tapeworm. Do the housemates run around with him? Are they going to the same places, or is this your farm dog or inside outside dog, but you got the little lap dog that never leaves the, you know, never leaves the defined confined space of your world, then the risk is much less. If I had outdoor cats, you know, and they all lived together, I would probably say it's probably a good idea. Let's just go ahead and treat them all. But you should test them, in my opinion. But, you know, so it really, what's different is you've got to think about this. Did the other animals in the household have the same opportunity to scavenge or predate on that intermediate host? And that will answer your question.
And in terms of the environmental impacts that, you know, you've had a patient that's tested positive, and you mentioned before about them, the life cycle, and then them passing those eggs or proglottids into the environment. Should we be doing something to treat the environment to minimize the effect of infection?
So that's where I go back to the most effective. Breaking the life cycle from a definitive host standpoint is fecal hygiene. Pick up the poop.
Yep.
If you know you have, especially where it's a big concern, would be known echinococcus multilocularis positives. But as soon as they shed the feces, if you pick it up and dispose of it in a container that other animals can't access, you've interrupted the life cycle. And the same with Tania. It takes a little longer for those eggs to become viable. But with any of these parasites, you know, even when we talk about hookworms and reinfecting dogs with hookworm, if you pick up the poop, they can't reinfect themselves.
Is it common that we see these as co-infections with other types of worms? So dogs that are going to be, or cats that are going to be positive definitive hosts for these tapeworm, are they likely... Do we often see it together with other worms? Because are these the ones that are out and about and just...
Yeah, so in general, yes. I mean, any animal that is out exploring its environment and eating various things is at a much higher risk for, like, the hookworm, roundworm, whipworm, the traditional nematodes. Because, again, even though those don't require definitive hosts, they require that the egg be shed and something to happen in the, you know, some life stage for them to then re-ingest and reinfect themselves or infect others. So while co-positives are still less common, yes, it's animals that are not as well, regulated is not the right word, but well housed in their, they have more time to do it, they're going to be more at risk than your, you know, I'll just go to your condo apartment dweller that lives on the 20th floor. And the only time they go outside is for a walk into the lemonade, and the poop gets picked up. That animal's probably a pretty low...
Handbag dog, yeah.
Yeah, that dog's going to be a pretty low risk versus the two that just ran out of here and barking at imaginary things, who they have free run of about 2 acres when they're outside. And is it anybody else? There shouldn't be anybody else's animals are exposed to, but I can't guarantee that, you know, that something didn't get, especially cats, didn't get in my yard. So those are the kind of things. And then, you know, you go to the far end, dogs that truly, you open the door and they get to go wherever they want to go until they decide to come home. They're probably at the top of the risk, especially like truly farm dog, working dogs, you know, that they load up and they go do a job. They're going to be exposed to a lot more stuff.
And in terms, now we have this test available, does this change anything in terms of how frequently we should test or screen our animals?
Well, as far as recommendations for frequency, I'm going to say it depends. In general, like Companion Animal Parasite Council North America recommends testing dogs and cats up to 4 times the first year of life and 1 to 2 times a year afterwards is a screening. The SCAP, or the European Scientific Companion Animal Parasite Council, they have similar recommendations. Where it's going to change, could potentially change, is if you were in a high risk area where you know that there's been a echinococcus being transmitted and you've had reports, especially in the wildlife. I think there are patients that I would recommend testing more frequently, is what I would say. again, those high-risk patients, primarily dogs more than cats, but if you've got a farm dog, a working dog, a hunting dog that goes out and has an opportunity to be exposed to these intermediate hosts, I think it would be a good idea to test those patients more frequently so you can uncover it earlier.
Okay, Wade, unfortunately, we are running out of time, so I am going to have to wrap up here. So I just want to finish by saying I hope that your Labrador energy doesn't put you at a higher risk of contracting any of these awful tapeworms. And on that note, if you could give us your final sort of three top tips for diagnosing tapeworm or avoiding tapeworms for our listeners.
I'd say the top three things is, you know, be aware of the patients that are at risk, first of all. But now that we have more sensitive and accurate methods that are going to be part of a routine screening, I think at minimum, you know, you should be testing these dogs and cats once a year to make sure that whatever program, if you're using something routinely, is it working? And then understand that, you know, that now with antigen is going to find more infections than traditional flotation. So you are going to uncover positives that are, if you have a flotation associated with it, is likely going to be negative. But this is likely, very likely a true positive. It's something that you should treat. And then the final thing, and I'm going to say this every time I talk about this, follow up. If you had a positive, you treated, you need to follow up and make sure that your treatment was effective. For the hookworm, roundworm, whipworm, nematodes, and the tapeworms, if you retest within 10 to 14 days, that test, the antigen test, should have gone negative if the treatment was effective. And it's not that many times you're not administering this, you're sending it home. The biggest reason why you get failure is compliance. The owner didn't give it effectively, and it's not that it's resistant. But that's the last thing, is if we did more of that, we could more effectively break these life cycles in many of these patients.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming in today, Wade.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in. Shake Up Your Workup aims to share helpful information and guidance. However, listeners are cautioned that diagnostic recommendations or discussions shared during this episode may not be applicable to every situation, and regulations regarding diagnostics and treatment may vary by region. Listeners should also consult with their own veterinarian or qualified animal health professional before making any decisions regarding any diagnostics, treatments, or patient care. And to learn more about topics discussed today, check the episode description for links to resources and free online courses on the IDEX Learning Center. Follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode of Shake Up Your Workup. We'd love to hear from you, so please share your feedback, your comments, or questions by emailing us at shakeupyourworkup@idex.com. And always, thanks for listening, and we'll be here next month when we shake up your workup with feline chronic kidney disease early intervention.